Hello, ladies and gentlemen. A good MLS draft season to you and yours. The waiver wire is just about set to go here, rather. Not expecting much news out of that. But a host of other interesting drafts are ahead, most pressing the re-entry draft, which will come up on Friday. We'll devote a big portion of this podcast to talking about that. But firstly, however, I'm joined by Michael Norton of Last Word on Sports. What holiday greetings would you like to give the people, Norton?
Shalom? Is that what they say for Hanukkah? I don't remember. Shout out to all our communities celebrating whatever holidays you'd like to celebrate. Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa. Festivus, all those holidays. My apologies if I've missed any, but yeah, season's greetings.
I feel like you might get in trouble for that one. At any rate, ahead on the show, we'll talk more off-season as well for all three Canadian teams. We'll get into what Don Garber has been talking about with regards to the state of Canada in Major League Soccer. And, of course, the 2026 World Cup bid, which is something that Canada is looking at. Yeah, but first let's start with the Major League Soccer Championship, the MLS Cup, which took place this past weekend. The Portland Timbers won in no small part thanks to Will Johnson's bench warming. at any rate, though, it was a big win for the Timbers. But the resounding thing coming out of this was whether or not it was good for the league that the Portland Timbers won. I mean, during the regular season, they were a team that were always on the playoff bubble throughout the competition, and then they just got hot at the right time of season. I know this is something that's always opened up when you have a format like Major League Soccer does, but at the same time, I mean, it almost feels like the best team didn't win in this case.
It's difficult, and I mean, yeah, it's tough. Because Major League Soccer has always been such a big advocate of parity, it's going to happen. You can't really avoid it. And people were coming into this matchup and saying, this is a really small market MLS Cup. I forget exactly, but I think it was like the 14th and the 18th smallest market, something like that, something stupid like that. And it showed on television. Even the viewership numbers were significantly down from last year. But again, you have to consider it being a small market MLS Cup. Last year, you had the LA Galaxy, you had the New England Revolution. So all of a sudden, you've got two big markets there. Then you've got the added allure of Landon Donovan's final professional game. And naturally, you would expect the viewership numbers to go down, even despite how well Major League Soccer did on TV this year. As for the championship itself, having Portland win, I don't think it's a bad thing necessarily. I think that Cascadia and the entire Pacific Northwest, they've been working really, really hard, and it's been showing on and off the field. And at some point, we knew that one of those sides was going to win. Would it be better for the league if Seattle won, maybe? Yeah, you could probably argue that, just because, again, it's a bigger market, and bigger markets have bigger dollars attached to them. But I think that Portland winning, I don't think it's a bad thing.
No, and these were two very well-built MLS teams. I mean, they did a lot of the right things to build their teams. And, you know, at the same time, you say small market, but that's not necessarily a bad thing for a league that is looking to build in maybe different markets than other leagues have taken advantage of in the past, because, you know, you've got, what, 150 teams in the New York area? You're not going to get that much exposure there. And
It's tough. And, I mean, if you want to look to expand, it's very difficult to get to extract even more revenue out of an existing market. They need to go to these new markets. And you look even at the cities that they're looking at, places like Sacramento, places like St. Louis, places like San Antonio. These aren't the markets that you come first to mind when you think of the United States of America. But these markets, they're big enough that they very well could sustain a professional team. And again, yeah, it's just, if they've got the resources and they've got everything clicking on and off the field, they could pull it off. So yeah, it is cool that you can see these small markets still, despite the increased spending and despite designated players and TAM and all this other stuff, like small markets can still thrive in this league.
Yeah, not necessarily the win that Major League Soccer would have wanted, but at the same time, the Portland Timbers have been a very committed team since joining Major League Soccer, so I don't think they'll have any problem with it. Not that they can publicly have any problem with any team winning. That would look quite bad on them if they were to, you know, come out and say, this was not the team we wanted to win.
Just going into the cup, just endorse a team.
Yeah. I feel like that's something FIFA will be doing in the near future.
Oh, boy.
At any rate, seeing all the MLS Cup stuff happening and how far away all the Canadian teams were, you know, you kind of wonder when's the next time, well, not the next time, when's the first time that a Canadian team will be involved? And this brought up the question, could a Canadian team be involved? And obviously they could, you know, we consider the Portland Timbers and they were a bubble playoff team. I believe that Toronto FC finished above them in the standings. I could be wrong on that. Actually, no, were Toronto the lowest?
Toronto were number six in the East. Portland were third in the West, but okay. I don't think they were too far on points.
No, so... yeah, even the lowest of the lows when it comes to Canadian soccer teams weren't that far off of the Portland Timbers. So at the same time, in a parity league, it could. But realistically, it's interesting to look at whether or not one of the Canadian teams could be in a place to win the Cup next year.
I think you have to look at it as a matter of who is heating up at the right time. I think that Montreal would definitely be a great example of that this year. And again, they just ran into a very, very well-oiled machine in Columbus. And I think that had they gotten by Columbus, I think there's a very good chance they take down New York. New York has been one of those teams that, yeah, again, they are a very well-organized team and they've got a lot of good pieces there, but they've never really been able to take that extra step. And you can say whatever, curse of the Metro or whatnot, but I think that if Montreal gets past Columbus, they have enough momentum to get past New York. So I think it's about being hot at the right time, and I think Portland definitely thrived from that. And like I said before, New England thrived from that in 2014.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting hypothetical, obviously. I think that, in my opinion, it's obviously the Vancouver Whitecaps who have made the most sustainable step forward this year. I mean, Toronto FC, sure, they could make the playoffs again. The Montreal Impact could as well, but at the same time, both of those teams relied way too heavily on one single star. In Vancouver, it was almost, you know, we could be better than this. They weren't playing, you know, up to their standard in terms of all the pieces that they had on that team. And at the same time, there wasn't a single player where you looked at and it was like, that player is getting them, you know, is getting them this far. They had so many different players on that team that could contribute. And they have depth that Montreal or Toronto doesn't have, so I think they would be the favorite going forward. But at the same time, there's a lot of other teams in MLS who will be looking for that cup next year. So it's a tough question to answer ahead of the offseason right now. Let's get into the offseason quickly. We'll start with Toronto FC. The re-entry draft is coming up this week. It's on Friday. And, you know, a lot of interesting questions going in because the re-entry draft is always an interesting time for clubs. They get to pick up players who are, you know, who are good MLS players, but at the same time, there's a lot of contract things they have to consider, and who knows who will be and won't be picked up, even established MLS names. It also means the first time there is free agency as well, which should add an interesting wrinkle to everything because there will be some MLS veterans who clubs will get to throw cash at versus just being ranked in a certain order of the draft, so you wonder if there'll be some overpayment there. We've seen in pretty much every other sport, free agency ends up in overpayment. Toronto FC do pick ninth in the re-entry draft on Friday. Do you see them taking anyone?
It's difficult because the re-entry draft, it's staged in two ways. The first stage that is happening this Friday, you need to take a player at the salary that their previous club declined to sign them at. So it's tough. Unless there's a situation where one team is really tight for cap space and another team has a boatload of it, there normally isn't a lot of movement in stage one. I think that stage two, the point where you can renegotiate and you can more likely sign them for a more affordable rate, I think that there we're going to see a lot more action, not just from Toronto FC, but league-wide. And I think that when you look at this list of re-entry eligible players, there's a lot of really interesting names here. You've got, just looking at it right now, in terms of goalkeepers, you've got, like we mentioned last week, Tally Hall. You've got even Zach McMath, who showed a lot of promise early on, but it seems like the goalkeeping glut in Philadelphia somehow pushed him to the periphery. You move up to defenders, Steven Betashore. That one absolutely boggles my mind how Vancouver have not re-signed him. Even more for defenders, you look at somebody like Jermaine Taylor, Seth Sinovic. Those are good names. Want me to go even farther? Another huge one that sticks out to me in midfield is Marco Papa. Like how he is, again, I think it's just a matter of that situation being in Seattle where they had five or six really, really talented offensive pieces. And just over the last year, they've let them all go. Kenny Cooper is gone. Lamar Nagel recently got traded. Chad Barrett, I believe, is going to be eligible, maybe even for free agency. I can't remember off the top of my head. and now Papa as well. And now basically all they've got left up top is Dempsey and Martins of that six-headed monster. That's all that's left. So there's interesting names. I don't know how much we're going to see in Stage 1. I think that this year there might be a bit more activity just because there are players like a Marco Papa or like a Steven Betashore who teams would definitely be willing to take on. So there could be more action in Stage 1.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, obviously the two positions that Toronto FC need majorly right now are a goaltender and defenders. And there are those players are available in this draft, so it's interesting to see, it will be interesting to see whether they try to take them in the first round or whether they hope that something still is still good for the second round. I'd argue that you don't want to take a goaltender in the first round. I don't know if Tally Hall would be the best pick in the first round, especially with some of the other options. I mean, there's so many goalkeepers around the world that they could bring in. But at the same time, I've been a big advocate for them looking at an MLS defender, and especially an MLS center back. I know Steven Betashore is a player who is really good and could be really good for Toronto FC. But at the same time, you know, I think their depth at right back, at left back is pretty decent. And I wouldn't be against, you know, a Mark Bloom playing there next season. Especially at the price Steven Betashore commands, I think you have to invest that in the central defending first. Which is why I look at a player like Chris Schuler, you know, formerly of Real Salt Lake, who could be a really interesting acquisition for Toronto FC. I mean, I believe he's just 28, so he's a couple of good years left in him. And, you know, he's almost exactly what you would be looking for if you're Toronto FC, which is an experienced MLS defender who has plenty of good years ahead of him and can, you know, come in and kind of control that back line, play alongside, you know, Damien Perkey, if that's who you're going to put him beside. So that would be who I'd look for, especially for Toronto FC. And if he's still available when they pick at number 9, I think that Toronto FC should at least try to get him. I would see a player like that going in the first round, regardless of whether or not, you know, a team wants to pay money for him.
I think you're right there. I think that, there, again, like we've said, this year there seemed to be a lot of really good options. I can't remember all the names that were on the 2014 list. I think...
Yeah.
Eddie Johnson was on one of these lists at some point, and there was a good roster there. But this year, it does really seem to stick out. In terms of defenders, like you were saying, I think that there's a lot of older defenders here. You look at a guy like Hassoun Kamara. You look at a guy like Pamadou Ka, like Lavelle Palmer, Zach Scott, these guys. I think that Schuler would be interesting just because he is a little bit younger than the options I just mentioned there. But yeah, it seems like there's good options on the outsides of defense. You got Kevin Alston, Betashore, like I was saying before, Seth Stanovic. In terms of the central options, yeah, I think that Schuler is the one that really sticks out.
Yeah, you have to be careful as well, though, because especially in the first round of the draft, you know, we've seen Toronto FC pick up players like Robbie Finley, who, you know, was kind of an anchor to them for most of that season in terms of his salary cap. So you have to, you know, if you're going to sign a player in the first round, you have to really consider their salary and have to see how that fits in. Now, free agency is open as well, and there have been reports coming from Grant Wall of Sports Illustrated that Toronto FC could be in on Drew Moore, 31-year-old center back of the Colorado Rapids this past season. That's another one that I wouldn't mind altogether. I mean, I'd prefer Chris Schuler if Toronto FC could get him just because, you know, of his age, of what I've seen of him versus Drew Moore. But Drew Moore was on a, you know, a Colorado Rapids team who couldn't score, but they were also pretty difficult to score against this past season. So I think that he could be a nice acquisition for Toronto FC as well.
Yeah, I agree with you there. In terms of defenders, again, the free agent list, there aren't as many free agents as there are for re-entry eligible players. No. Drew Moore is definitely the one that stands out on defense. There's a few others like Bobby Berling and Ty Harden that are sort of they're sort of a run-of-the-mill sort of player. But yeah, Drew Moore for years has been anchoring that Colorado back line, and he would be a great option. I even look farther up the field, somebody like Jeff Larenowicz. I mean, he's been playing as a defender in Chicago for a long time, and yes, yeah. I think he was bred to be a midfielder, but he has that defensive experience in Chicago. I would not be opposed to signing him in Toronto. I think that the thing with him is that he would command a decent bit of money, which is the difficulty, and he is older than somebody like Schuler.
Yeah.
But as a one-year option, as a two-year option maybe, I think it could be possible. And in Larenowicz, you get somebody who you know is going to give you that consistency, who's going to keep a very organized back line. Yes, it's going to come at a price, but Ahmed Kantari came at a price too, and look what we got out of him, right?
Yeah, not much.
Not much.
You know, you could always go Eric Avila as well. No? No?
No.
Okay, no. Yeah, the last one that I would kind of key in on a little bit, if he is available now, from what I've heard, Sporting Kansas City is the favorite to acquire him, but Justin Mapp, if you can get him at a decent price, would add a lot to a Toronto FC on the wing, a position that they didn't have depth in this past season and were forced to play some pretty wonky position or forced to play some pretty wonky tactics to try and compensate for this. You know, I think if you have the option of getting a player like Justin Mapp, you don't ask questions. You just pull the trigger. He's a really, really solid player and one that, you know, would have a good fit on any of the three Canadian teams. With that, let's move on to the Montreal Impact. Montreal, last time we recorded, hadn't made their final roster move, so we'll just go over them quickly. They did pick up the options on Evan Bush, Eric Kronberg, Canadian goalkeeper Maxime Crépeau, Donny Toya, André Lefebvre, Eric Miller, Kyle Becker, Eric Alexander, Max Tissot, and Anthony Jackson-Hamel. They also signed contracts for Jeremy Gagnon-Lapierre and Dominic Oduro, a favorite of this show.
Oh, yeah.
The only players they really let go, they declined options on Hassoun Kamara and Ken E. Cooper, while Dilly Duca and Justin Mapp have received new contract offers, but are right now out of contract, and with the case of Mapp, obviously, as I said, Sporting Kansas City is the favorite to sign him, but he is a free agent as of right now. You know, I think it's interesting that they've stayed the course so much. I like, you know, biasly, I guess, I like the fact that they're bringing back a bunch of their young Canadians who I think showed well for them. I think Maxime Crépeau could be a good young goalkeeper in the future. Kyle Becker, I'm a little surprised they brought back considering what he's had, but I mean, I don't think he's paid a whole bunch of money. So, you know, he's a good depth player in Major League Soccer and one that, you know, is going to be capped by Canada a bunch. So why not keep him? Max Tissot had a good season for them, and Anthony Jackson-Hamel is just starting to break into that 11 as well. So, yeah, it's staying the course kind of in Montreal, and that's not necessarily a bad move.
No, I would agree with you. I think that, again, what I'm seeing from this is there's a decent bit of depth players, and like you were saying with the young Canadians.
Yeah.
But again, you wonder where that support is, because Kenny Cooper, yes, people can say, oh, he's declining. And yeah, I would say so. But keep in mind, in 2012, I think he scored 18 goals with the New York Red Bulls. And I frankly think he can still score in Major League Soccer. He has scored in Major League Soccer basically wherever he's gone. And again, considering Didier Drogba and his age, you wonder who is going to support him, because it's not going to be Dominic Oduro. Regardless, yes, he can score, but is he like a really solid number two? I don't think so. You look at guys like Dilly Duca and Justin Mapp, and those would be really big losses for Montreal as well. So, I mean, they've got a lot of good pieces. Again, the Drogba, Piatti, Simon, but you wonder, where's Simon's defensive partner? Where is that depth behind Drogba? Those are two big midfielders to lose, too. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, now switching to Montreal for the re-entry draft and who potentially they could pick up. One player that stood out to me, knowing that he is in this re-entry draft, would be Maxi Arruti of the Portland Timbers. This would definitely be, for me, a second round of the re-entry draft pickup, because you'd have to sign him at a lower salary, considering probably what he makes as a player who was formerly a designated player. Was he a designated player on Portland? I can't remember.
Was he a DP in Toronto?
He was a DP in Toronto, okay. So I'm not exactly sure.
For all 37 minutes,
yeah,
or something?
Exactly. Yeah, that was ridiculous. But, you know, he'd be a player that would be pretty interesting for the Montreal Impact to pick up, just because he scores. That's simply what they need off the bench, is another player who can score. If Didier Drogba, you know, dries up or, you know, needs a game off, which obviously at his age is going to happen.
He is not going to score a goal a game for the next 5 years. I think this year will be another good year for him. But frankly, he's not even signed until after this year. Yeah. So who knows? And again, he can retire whenever he wants to. He's played for long enough and he's old enough that he knows that whenever he wants to call it time, he'll call it time.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, Maxi Arruti would be a nice pickup for them. Other than that, you know, it's pretty thin up in the striking ranks, both in the free agency and Yeah, and in the reentry draft, you know, you could go for a guy like Alan Gordon, who, again, another guy who scores in Major League Soccer, but would be pretty expensive for what he gets, you know, or what he brings to the table.
Could go for Mike McGee.
Yeah, you could always go for Mike McGee, but at the same time, again, he has been good recently, but at the same time, you know, there's a lot of aging strikers. It seems to be a coupling of aging strikers or young strikers who have done pretty much nothing yet between these two. So between the free agency and the reentry draft. So, you know, I think Maxi Rudy might be the only forward who really stands out for that group.
He definitely stands out. And again, looking even at the free agent list, that's a lot of goals. Like when you add up all the goals between those six guys, that is an insane number of goals. But you do wonder, a lot of these guys have dried up. So Rudy's definitely an option. I think, let's see, even pull up this re-entry list, shall we? Of the forwards, so yeah, Rudy is the main one, I would say. Two guys who really haven't performed that well in Colorado, Vicente Sanchez, who's great at penalties, but otherwise hasn't done too much. And then, yeah, it's a lot of young guys like Chandler Hoffman, Antoine Hopinot. Like, it's difficult. I don't know.
Well, and the new mandate in Major League Soccer seems to be spending money on forwards from abroad as well. So you almost wonder there if, you know, versus picking up a guy like Chad Barrett or Edson Buttelin or Connor Casey even, who are almost MLS 1.0 or 2.0, however the 0.0s are going at this point, but whatever the last edition of MLS Striker is, and instead, you know, spending that same money or similar money on bringing in, you know, a talent from South America or Europe who could do the same job but heard a better job even and have more of a, you know, play different roles. You know, Connor Casey's a target man, that's what he is. Chad Barrett is a target man, that's what he is.
You've got a lot of setup guys. Again, yeah, I mentioned Marco Papa before, but even somebody like Ricardo Clark, somebody like Ned Grabovoy, even, that's an interesting one there. Again, saying Justin Mapp, you got a lot of setup guys, but you don't have that guarantee, apart from a Rudy, who is probably the closest thing to it, you don't have that guaranteed ball in the back of the net, cherry on top person.
No, and, you know, looking again, moving on to the Vancouver Whitecaps, again, a Rudy would be the player who I would suggest most for them. I think he's almost the perfect fit for what they need at the moment, unless, of course, they're wanting to go outside of Major League Soccer, which is always an option for them. But we talked last podcast at length about how they don't have that definitive goal scorer, and when Octavio Rivero's goals dried up, so did, you know, the team's goals. So, at, you know, while they have all those young forwards, it would be great to bring in a player like Rudy who, you know, could bring them that consistency and, you know, add something different that they don't already have.
I think every team in Canada, now that I think about it, every Canadian club needs that solid number two, and a Rudy is that. You look at Toronto, they've got a boatload of guys who are being paid a boatload of money and aren't doing very much of anything. Montreal, they don't have any depth. Vancouver, they've got a lot of depth, and it's a lot of guys that are cheap, but no one has really stood out. So I think that a Rudy is a really interesting piece, now that I think about it, for every Canadian club to look at.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know if you'd want to look at him if you're Toronto FC, just because how much money you have, you know, wrapped up in traditional strikers.
You'd have to offload.
You would have to.
No questions asked.
Yeah, that's why I think like a Justin Mapp would be a better fit, or, you know, again, someone from outside of Major League Soccer as a winger, or even in a trade. Because I don't think Toronto FC necessarily needs to look for another nine. They need to look for another winger to add to their attack and get more goals that way. A difficult ask, of course, but
Marco Papa would be sick, and frankly, again, he's the name that sticks out for me. But Toronto's picking ninth, and they do have teams, dare I even say, Chicago. I mean, he's got the connection with Chicago, playing there a number of years and doing very well there. Would he potentially go number one? Maybe not, but you have to wonder. And again, there's eight teams picking ahead of Toronto that need even more help than they do. So
yeah, and it's almost dangerous to look at these two lists and consider, you know, these are the only players that Toronto FC, this isn't an NHL or an NBA. There are leagues outside of this that they can go out and pick up. So looking at it this way, they almost limit themselves, and you wonder if they'll, you know, if they will bring in players from outside of the league to help supplement some of these positions. You know, Hanson Boakai is one who's already been rumored. I don't know if he'd be a starter for the club. I highly doubt that, but, you know, he would add some pace on the wing that they wouldn't have already.
If the price is right, then I think that, again, even looking to the European market, a lot of that comes down to price.
Yeah, and the same with Vancouver, you know, if they, you know, again, Hanson Boakai would be not a bad fit for them, but, I think that it should be interesting to see what the three Canadian teams do, because I would almost expect all three of them to have some sort of move between the drafts. But round one, I don't know if any of them will be willing to take on, you know, a significant amount of salary unless, you know, like a Chris Schuler or somebody big is available at that time. Now, let's move on a little bit to more Canadian soccer in general. I know we've talked about the three Canadian clubs and, you know, the re-entry draft position. Do you have your laser pointer out?
I might.
You just get so excited about Canadian soccer and CONCACAF. You've already got the laser pointer ready to go. He's trying to point it in my eyes just to, you know, distract me as I'm doing this segment. And it is working, let me tell you. at any rate, Don Garber, Kurt Larson of the Toronto Sun recently, I guess, got Don Garber to do sort of Canadian State of the League, which is something he doesn't always talk about because, you know, only three teams in this league are Canadian. They're in an interesting position where Canada has kind of its own problems that aren't necessarily on front and center for the league's problems, and nor should they be considering the percentage of the league Canada takes up. But one of the main point of interest, I guess, is the roster rules for Canadian players. And, you know, as of right now, Canadian players are considered international, so they have to be, you know, they have to be signed as international players in those limited international spots. Now, if you're looking between a 24-year-old Colombian player and a 24-year-old Canadian, you know, just off the top of your head, not even looking at anything else, you take the 24-year-old Colombian. So that's been the problem with Canadian players getting on teams who aren't Toronto FC, even who are Toronto FC, the Vancouver Whitecaps and the Montreal Impact, because, you know, very few Canadians started other than, you know, Jonathan Osorio and sometimes Russell Tybert, and sometimes Max Tissot with Montreal, and Ashton Morgan, I guess you could throw in as well. But, you know, four Canadians starting on Canadian teams, that's pretty rough. So Major League Soccer is looking at potentially. Now, what was interesting was the discrepancy between what Don Garber said and what Victor Montaliani, who is the CSA president, said. Don Garber made it sound like, you know, there's potential for an incentive to come in that would add Canadian players, or that would make it more, I guess, favorable to add Canadian players to your team. Well, Victor Montaliani was pretty much like, it'll be done before the 2016 MLS season. What could you see MLS doing to have more Canadian players in the league next season?
I think that you're hitting on a really good point with how you compare a Canadian to a Colombian or a Brazilian or an Italian or something like that. They just do not have that same brand appeal.
No.
One of the books I've been trying to read, and school's been pushing that off to the side, Soccernomics is brilliant, but it has a chapter talking about this sort of thing. It's nationalities like Canadians, like Scandinavians, like whatever, they're just not appealing. They don't have that same appeal. And there could be an absolute star in the making in those. You turn back the clock a few years on Simeon Jackson or something like that, and that would be an example of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's just, they overall, as a whole, they don't carry that same brand appeal. So there has to be something done because they're not going to draw that just out of will, I guess. There needs to be something put on paper that guarantees that these Canadians are going to get a spot, because they're not going to anyways.
No.
And we're seeing that now. We get three domestic Canadians. You have to have a minimum of three domestic Canadians if you're a Canadian team. That is literally nine Canadians in a 20-team Major League Soccer that has 20 players. That's 9 out of 400. Fine if it's elsewhere, but this is North America we're talking about, and that seems really strange.
Well, this is especially the reason why, you know, Canada right now is really putting in gears a Canadian league of their own, is because there isn't a place domestically for young Canadians to play. Because, you know, in Major League Soccer, there's what, like 20 Canadians, if that, you know, between all of the teams. And there's very few who are getting jobs outside of Canada. You can count them almost on your hand. You know, Carl Wimay, Marcel DeYoung, Will Johnson, Kyle Larin. I'm obviously missing a couple, but it's very difficult to get a job outside of Canada. We've seen a couple start and then just fizzle out, you know, like a Kyle Porter or something like that, where, you know, at some point it doesn't make sense anymore for these clubs to keep the Canadian players because they're taking up spots that are just so valuable on the roster.
That's the thing. It's going to be tough because as soon as you say, oh, every club needs to have, even if it's one Canadian,
yeah,
which frankly is still not very much. No. I'm sure the CSA would want more, but realistically, that's what it's got to start at. You throw that in. That's, again, that's one roster spot out of 20, and clubs are going to complain out of that because, yeah, that's, oh, you could say that's only whatever percent of the roster, yeah. 2.5% of the roster, 5% of the roster, my apologies.
Mm-hmm.
5% of the roster, oh, that's still too much for Canadians. Frankly, I would argue the same thing, but you can't say, oh, have half a Canadian or have a Canadian every 3 years. It yeah. needs to be that, which I don't, logistically, I don't think it's worth that yet. But if we don't do anything, then nothing
happens. That
sounded like an obvious Michael Owen there. If we don't do anything, nothing's going to change. But something has to be done. And yeah, it doesn't make sense logistically because, yeah, the talent pool isn't there. And are they worth that roster spot? Maybe not. But this is still a North American league, and I think that they need to have that representation, whether it's worth it or not.
You wonder almost, and I mean, one of the things that Don Garber said was he doesn't want to have another way to circumvent the salary cap because that's something that happens a lot. But if you had a roster spot, like an added roster spot where it's like you could sign a Canadian player with this, like it has to be a Canadian player, but this can go above the cap. You almost wonder if that would help out as teams looked at like someone like David Edgar and were like, okay, if we have this extra money to splash on a player like that, they could do it. But you know, it's pretty difficult, barring them making Canadians domestic players, which, yeah, it becomes difficult because of the international tag they do put on players. Yeah, it's going to be incredibly difficult to find Canadians, you know, a rule to make Canadians more favorable for teams.
It's very tough because if you put Canadians and Americans in the same group as a lump sum,
yeah.
all these players are domestic, Americans are going to get favored. And then all of a sudden you might even see the Canadian clubs, they might drop some of their other Canadians. And you don't want to, it's tough because if you add that rule where you can have a 21st roster spot
yeah.
that has to be Canadian, that you can spend whatever money, the market does not have enough Canadians like a David Edgar type or a Simeon Jackson type even, where you could say, yeah, I'm going to spend a lot of money on this type of player or a decent amount of money, rather. Probably wouldn't be a lot.
Mm.
So they don't have that. And then that spot, all of a sudden, it's like, oh, we've got our token Canadian player. Like, I'm sorry if that's harsh, but
no.
it could descend into that. And I don't think that is a better situation than having, say, one roster spot that has to be a Canadian. It's like, oh, this is a waste of a roster spot. Like, it's becoming that either way. They need to find something.
No, and one of the things that's kind of interesting that Canadian U20 coach Rob Gale talked about when I talked to him earlier this week was, you know, like it's twofold here. Like, we don't just have to find spots for Canadians. We have to force Canadians into those spots, you know? Like, you can talk to every Canadian coach or coach of a Canadian MLS team, and what are they going to say? We're not just going to start Canadians. These Canadians have to be good enough that we can be competitive with these Canadians. We're not, you know, if you're a top club in a top league, you can't be there just to develop Canadian players. I know it's an important thing, and I know it's something Toronto FC's talked about, but that can't be the end of the day. You have to win games. That's the most important thing for any club and any roster. So, you know, these Canadians have to somehow become good enough that they're forcing their way, they're knocking down the doors, and, you know, MLS teams are going to have to, you know, like Kyle Larin, you know, like, there's no way Orlando can't keep him because he was the best rookie of the year and one of the best strikers in the league this season. So, you know, whereas other players, you know, like Kyle Becker on, you know, Kyle Becker versus Tetsuo Akindele on FC Dallas, Kyle Becker was wishy-washy, and that's why they traded him to Montreal, whereas Tetsuo Akindele has consistently played well and made himself, you know, a player that they can't get rid of, basically.
Mm-hmm. I think that it's tough, though, because you see, again, like you were saying, having these Canadians, is that a detriment to these teams? From a developmental standpoint, it's absolutely not. But then again, it's, oh, this is a waste of a spot. This is going to hurt our aspirations. And you see that with Toronto and Montreal, even. Their academies, they're not getting, more so Toronto than Montreal, and even more so Vancouver's academy is still producing and getting the most minutes out of the Canadian clubs. But yeah, you wonder, oh, this academy system, yeah, it's working for teams like Dallas or something like that, who are just churning out homegrown talent, but they have a larger talent pool to select from. It's an American talent pool, so it is domestic down there.
Yeah.
And is it worth it? Toronto FC doesn't think so. They're spending the money. They're going out and trying to win in other ways. And so, yeah, it's just a sense of, do Canadians give these teams a chance to win? You look back in league history, and you've got guys like Pat Onstad and Dwayne DeRosario who definitely have.
Yeah.
But aside from Laren, who has had one good season, and Akindele, who is now better than a role player, and somebody like Will Johnson, who knows what's going to happen to him next, are there enough of those Canadians to say that this is worth a big investment, this is worth a roster slot, this is worth whatever you want to say?
No, and you almost see Canadian players, you know, coming up through. Like, you talk about the academy ranks, one of the interesting things is they seem to come up and they seem to hit a plateau where it's like, okay, we're not good enough, or we're not ready for Major League Soccer, we're going to go one of two ways. One way seems to be, like, out of soccer altogether, which seems to happen to a couple. And then, you know, maybe there's been a couple of, you know, diamonds in the rough almost. And Michael Petrasso, you wonder how Toronto FC let him go. He'd be a perfect fit for them right now for several years. He's starting at Queen's Park Rangers as a winger. You know, so that's... you know, it's tough to see a player like that go, but at the same time, if they're not ready for Major League Soccer, it's hard to find a spot for them. And, you know, even at Jordan Hamilton, he's caught behind all of these other strikers at Toronto FC. Chris Minella, he's caught behind a bunch of midfielders at Toronto FC. Manny Aparicio, who they let go, was caught behind Chris Minella and a bunch of other midfielders at Toronto FC. So finding those spots, you know, you can't just force them to...
I think that's part of why they've got the USL partnership now, though. It's giving those players those opportunities. The ones, again, it's the bridge between the academy system and Major League Soccer, having this USL partnership in place. But again, it's, yeah, is this the plateau that players hit? I mean, the USL is definitely an up-and-coming league, and it's great. But it is still, it's below Major League Soccer.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's going to be viewed as... It is a minor league in the United States. It's a major minor league, but it's still not the top drawer.
Yeah.
And is that where we put the Canadian players? Is it, oh, yeah, you sign them, but then use up our one roster slot or whatnot, and then send them right down here so they can win us a championship that not as many people are going to care about, not as many people have the interest in, and let's spend our actual resources on winning the big one. I think they got to use USL, and they have been using USL for guys like Jordan Hamilton. But yeah, it's difficult because you want to shoot higher than that. I think it's a good starting point for sure, but we got to set the bar.
And now let's move on to the other topic that has been coming out of Canadian media recently, which is the 2026 World Cup. That, you know, Canada is going to bid on this. It looks like they're going forward with it. And by the way things are shaping up, there seems to be a lot of political interest, which is something that, you know, is a big deal for stuff like this, because you have to get the politicians involved if you want to get something moving forward. The question then becomes, is this a good idea for Canadian soccer? I mean, you can talk about, you know, how big of an impact it's had on other nations and, you know, how big of a deal it is to host a World Cup, but, you know, investing so much in something like this, you know, especially with how shaky FIFA is right now, that's the main thing that I've heard argued is, you know, with the way FIFA is right now, with how corrupt it is this a great idea for Canada to get involved in?
That's an interesting point. I think that you look at Canada and they've had some big events. They had the Women's World Cup in 2015. They had the Pan American Games, which, bigger event or not, it was an investment, like you said. Vancouver, those Olympics there. And Toronto apparently is bidding for the Olympics every 5 minutes now.
U20 World Cup as well in 2007.
Yeah, very true as well. I was at a few of those games for the men's. Yeah, it was great.
Hopefully you didn't go into any Canada games.
I did. Canada-Argentina, I believe it was. Sergio Aguero was at that tournament. He was killing it. But you look at those sort of tournaments, maybe the Olympics comes close to it, but in terms of a national-level spending spree and just a huge amount of, again, spending and infrastructure and all that, the World Cup pales all those other ones. This is going to be unprecedented if they do it. And, yeah, you could argue that they've got the infrastructure in place or they're building the infrastructure that they need. But I don't know. There is going to be spending on this. And, I'm just trying to think where to go with this. CONCACAF, they have not had a World Cup since 1994, and they have made it very, very clear, the United States especially, that they want a World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult looking at it, because if you get locked in a bidding process, FIFA is very obviously going to lean towards the United States. They're 10 times bigger. They have more money to spend on this. They've got a bigger player pool. They've got a stronger national program. It's going to be tough to go up against that sort of juggernaut. I think that FIFA would like to put it into CONCACAF. I think that, again, seeing Russia and Qatar, they're trying to put it into the not England's and Germany's and places like that. So I think that Canada has a shot. It's just going up against the United States, it's going to be very difficult for them to win against our rivals from the South.
Yeah, absolutely, it would be difficult. But yeah, at the same time, you know, if FIFA's trying to save face here, you know, giving it to Russia, giving it to Qatar, and giving it to all those like non-traditional soccer markets that where it's looked, you know, they've all been so corrupt apparently, you know, in those bidding processes, giving it to Canada, where like a country that maybe it wouldn't be as corrupt, giving it to, would almost save face a little bit. It'd be like, oh look, we gave it to another country that's not, you know, necessarily big in soccer.
I guess that's the thing, too. I mean, you look at the United States, somebody as big as the United States is and as much as they've been pushing for this stuff to have the World Cup in 2026 or even earlier in 2018 or 2022, there's going to be, I think Canada, if you look at it at a global scale, I think that people might actually be happier if Canada gets it because people hate the United States. Let's be real here. We like you. We like you, your American friends, but across the world, there might be a bit more animosity towards that. It's saying, oh, the United States, how much did they pay for it? What sort of stuff went on? You're just doing this to make them happy so they don't rip you apart and file more corruption cases against you. Everyone likes Canada. I think that it's an interesting idea.
Well, we like to think everyone likes Canada. Sure everyone likes Canada. But at the same time, you almost wonder if all the things that have gone on in terms of Americans investigating the FIFA corruption, if that'll hurt their bid as well.
Yeah, no, because, I think
if you're FIFA, you're not very happy at the United States of America right now.
No.
not that America's doing anything wrong necessarily in this. You know, they're trying to cut out corruption from FIFA, at least that's what the above board platform seems to be for them doing all of this. Who knows what the motivation is otherwise, but yeah, that can't put them in FIFA's good books right now, as you know, more and more FIFA executives are being arrested, it seems, weekly at this point. But you talked about that 1994 World Cup in the United States, and you know,
in terms of attendance, it is still the most attended World Cup. And in terms of infrastructure spending, they didn't have to. They have, it's football stadiums, but they had them. And you have, like, every stadium with a capacity of 60,000 plus. It was easy for them in terms of that. And, yeah, there's going to be spending elsewhere, but having that stuff in place definitely helped the United States.
Well, it's almost like it could almost be the same for Canada, though. That's what really launched. People forget that the United States weren't a traditional soccer market. You know, they've made themselves so strong in the past couple of years that, you know, they're almost seen like, oh, the big giants from CONCACAF, the USA. Well, a couple of years ago, well, well past Norton and I's lifetime, they were about the same as Canada. And this 94 World Cup, it meant they were spending money on soccer. It meant the general public were, you know, involved. And it meant Major League Soccer, which, you know, has been massive for the United States development overall. So if Canada could have something similar happen where they built stadiums, you know, they got the general public interested, not just in soccer, but in Canadian soccer, which is always an issue here. Everyone's interested in soccer, or not quite everyone. There's always going to be the hockey truthers out there who still, you know, say soccer is a sport for divers and whiners and that sort of thing. That's the way the Canadian market goes. But there's a lot of people here who love soccer. They just don't like Canadian soccer because, let's face it, it's not the most attractive soccer out there. It's not the most interesting. It's not the Premier League, that's for sure. But this could really be the defining moment for Canadian soccer if they were to get this World Cup.
I think that a World Cup definitely has that ability. I think that you look at it even from a population standpoint. Canada, as we know, is a massive, massive immigration hub. And I think that it just sort of takes time. There's a huge amount of Canadians that have just come to Canada in the last 15, 20 years. They can put their kids in soccer maybe, yeah, again, to maintain the culture, I guess, of wherever they came from. And maybe not those kids, but maybe once those kids have their own kids that are in soccer, maybe we're going to see it more, that we're getting more of that influence and our programs are getting stronger. There's still a huge amount of Canadians that play organized soccer. And yeah, like you said, the interest in soccer is there, but I think that it's going to take either winning, which, yep, I don't know. It's, we haven't qualified for a World Cup since I believe 1986 or 82.
That's the
was
only
it?
Time.
86 was, yeah, the only
the
time.
Only World Cup.
And so it's either going to take winning or a wow event. And the FIFA World Cup is most definitely a wow event.
Yeah, no kidding. Even bidding for this tournament could be big for Canadian soccer.
If it goes somewhere. I mean, the Toronto, yeah, Olympic bid, for example, fell flat pretty quickly. It needs to actually have legs.
Well, I feel like it would. I feel like they would actually go full in on this. And what could that mean? That could mean a new Canadian league, which is something we mentioned just a bit ago, and something that could be huge for Canadian soccer. I mean, you know, how viable is it? That's always going to be the question. But at the same time, as a D2 league, compared to Major League Soccer, of course, it could mean, you know, so many roster spots for Canada. It could mean, you know, if they get the investment right, a great 8-team league or whatever would be huge for Canadian soccer, for the interest, you know, if they get a major TV deal, all of these things. It could be absolutely massive. And if that comes out of a 2026 World Cup bid, then that could forward Canada significantly.
I think you're fair. I think even there's got to be a point sometimes when all these leagues, clarity is always nice.
Yeah.
You've got Major League Soccer undoubtedly is the top. Regardless of whatever the NASL tries to do, they're not claiming this top league status until they get a team west of Missouri. we know that. And
yeah,
the U.S. Soccer is making that very clear too. I think that if you have Major League Soccer as the top league in North America being Canada and the United States, you have the USL as the second division in the United States, and you have insert league here as being the second division league in Canada,
yeah,
I think that makes things a whole lot clearer. Again, my apologies, any NASL fans that are listening, but at some point, you got to look at the lower leagues. I'll still look at the lower leagues, and it's like, what the heck is going on? Like,
yeah,
it's so murky sometimes. And I think that would clear things up. The issue would be, say, again, a Toronto FC2 or a Whitecaps FC2, where do they decide to play? Do they think that this Canadian league has the talent that will, again, grow these players and develop them into Major League Soccer League players? Major League Soccer League, sorry. Add an extra league there. Or do you keep them in the U.S. system? I think that the Canadian system, if it has enough talent, I think it could over time. I think that initially it would be a difficult sell. But I think that, again, it's just something that's going to take time.
Well, it sounds like they wouldn't be interested necessarily in having the Canadian USL teams involved. I think Major League Soccer, the three Canadian Major League Soccer franchises would be completely separate from this league. They would not be involved. They're still looking for a team in Toronto and Vancouver. Apparently, this is the holdup. Now, Dwayne Rollins, at the 24th minute on Canadian Soccer News, he's the big I guess he knows the most about this league. And I guess that's where the holdup point is. And, you know, even comments from Victor Montaliani have suggested, you know, they do want teams in Toronto and Vancouver, but they wouldn't be Toronto FC 2 and Vancouver Whitecaps 2, who I'm not sure the ruling on this, but I think Major League Soccer and USL have a partnership where they wouldn't look too kindly on the three Canadian teams leaving for another league.
I would assume so. They want to keep that intact, like, and
I think it would be completely separate from those three Canadian teams. You look at, though, like a team like the Ottawa Fury. That would be where this gets interesting, is whether or not Ottawa and FC Edmonton would be willing to give up what they have created in NASL, which is not insignificant. I mean, obviously, Montreal made the final of the Soccer Bowl this year. And
Ottawa. You said Montreal.
Oh, I did, yeah. I did, very much.
That's all right.
Hey, they're close enough.
Yeah,
people in those markets are not going to be happy with me for that statement. But, yeah, they've been building something incredible there, and you know, would they be willing to give that up to try this Canadian league, which probably for the first couple of years would be a little step down. Yeah, it will be a step down for them. But at the same time, you know, if they could be that dynasty team or right off the bat, you know, they were rocking the Canadian Soccer League and giving an example of this is how you do it right, then maybe that would be good for Canada soccer as well.
Again, it's an issue. Does Canada, or do Canadian teams, do they have the confidence to break away from the American teams and say, we can do this by ourselves? I think that's an issue here. The NASL faithful, I love you all. You're wonderful people. They have held on for a very long time. They're still really pushing. And, yeah, they do have a great league. It's by no means is it insignificant.
Mm.
But, yeah, do the Canadian teams, do they need to use the Americans? Or do we think we have that by ourselves? Again, like you said, and like I said before, initially, I don't think we do. It is going to take time, but it is a matter of starting and accepting that, yeah, the first few years, it's going to be a very rocky path, not having the American system, an American, like, that talent pool to rely on. But over time, we don't know how long that period of time is going to be, but over time, it will improve. It's a difficult sell.
To wrap up this discussion a little bit and to get back to the 2026 World Cup, one of the things that I've kind of struggled with, and I know a lot of other people have, is whether or not there's just enough stadiums, enough stuff like that. Because every time you bring up, you know, Canada's bidding on the 2026 World Cup, the question is, so where are we playing it? I don't know how, like, there's very few, you know, stadiums in Canada that are FIFA, you know, FIFA equivalent. And the ones that are, you know, Montreal Olympic Stadium, which is falling apart, and, you know, I don't think that would be FIFA eligible. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not they're ready to spend money on, you know, expanding, say, a BC place and putting in grass. Because let's be honest here, it was for the Women's World Cup, it was played on turf, but, you know, the Men's World Cup, they might have different stipulations. Is that fair? No, but it's probably what's going to happen.
I agree with you. I think that, yeah, it is going to be grass. It's very unfortunate that the game still has that gender divide, and obviously the female players will definitely know a lot more about that and will be very opinionated on that.
Yeah.
It'll be played on grass, no questions asked. It will have to be. When you look at the infrastructure, I think that the record for stadiums used in a World Cup was 20, if I'm not mistaken. That was when Korea and Japan hosted. I think as of right now, what it normally is 10. I don't know what the minimum is in the current format.
Well, yeah, that was one of the things discussed was the fact that Qatar has 8, so Canada would also be probably pushing 8 because they don't want to push more than 8.
Yeah, they're not going to spend any more than they have to, I think. Obviously, do we have the money to spend? I guess that's a whole other question in itself based on our economy. But, yeah, they're not going to say, oh, we're going to build 12 stadiums and only use 8. They're only going to spend what they absolutely need to spend. And, yeah, that's an issue. So it's not only having the stadiums, but it's having the markets that, yeah, there's going to be tourism, without a doubt. There are going to be people that come over. But, again, if we're saying we want to build the Canadian game in this Canadian league, you need to have those cities that are going to attract enough Canadian fans. And, you knock off the easy ones. Toronto, Vancouver, Montreal. Where do you go next? I'm looking at your list here. You've got Edmonton, Ottawa, Winnipeg. After that, it's tough.
Yeah.
Like, where do you go next? Because, yeah, you want this to be a a national thing. You're not going to go up to like Yellowknife and build a stadium. We know that. But how many big Canadian markets are there? Is this something that is reasonable? Again, I'm sorry if I keep harping on it, but going to the United States, you can easily, blindfolded, throwing darts, you could pick 10 markets.
Yeah.
And you would still have probably another 10, if not 20 markets that would say, this is unfair, we want the World Cup here, why do these markets get it? That's another interesting thing for Canada, not just the stadiums, but how many big markets there are that could do this.
What if one of those darts hits Guam?
What?
I'm just kidding.
Or like just one of those the really tiny, like whatever U.S. Confederate sort of thing, yeah. Like American Samoa.
Yeah, there you go. I'm not even sure if is American Samoa owned by the United States?
I don't know, frankly. Something like that, though.
We're testing our geography here. Yeah, I'm curious. You know, they've said all these stadiums are expandable, but, like, what great architectural feat will it be to make BMO Field, like, 60,000 seats?
BMO Field is not a World Cup venue. People will tell you otherwise with these renovations and putting up. Yeah, yeah. It looks fantastic, and they're saying, oh, this could be great for football and winter classics and things like that. BMO Field is not a World Cup venue. If it is a World Cup venue, it is not. It is a group stage World Cup venue. It is not your marquee place. So that's even, I just sort of thought came into my head.
Yeah.
Where is your marquee place? People in Toronto are going to say Toronto, Toronto, Toronto.
Yes.
Vancouver right now has probably got the most likely one in BC Place,
mm-hmm.
but they need grass. No questions asked. So, yeah, it's, I don't know. It's sort of giving every city their fair share. And then you even look out east, someplace like Moncton, they've got a stadium there. They could probably expand it. But is that a market that you want to go to?
No, probably not for a men's World Cup. Mm-hmm. You know, can you
have entirely.
Can you have bunk bed seats where it's like one stand on top of the other? Or is that too... No, yeah, it'll be incredible to see, you know, if they go forward with this, how they're gonna figure this out, because it feels like a project that'll be put together very, very fast, as the infrastructure doesn't already exist, and that might be something that, you know, might be something that FIFA kind of looks at and says, well, you know, where are you going with this,
yeah,
guys?
Yeah, and again, in the United States, they will be able to have markets. In Canada, you've got the easy ones to name off, but then it's a matter, do you have enough to make this reasonable to mm-hmm. do? Do you have to partner with the United States to have enough markets? Because then, if Canada partners with the United States, which I don't think they've been talking about, they would want to do this completely independently. But if Canada partners with the United States, this will become viewed as a United States tournament, and Canada
Absolutely.
Will be on the side. And all of a sudden, you're not going to have that same impact.
Yeah, yeah. That is the issue. You know, it becomes another Major League Soccer where...
yeah, where Canada just gets pushed to the side. Good analogy there.
Yeah. I guess we'll wrap up that discussion there. Just finally, we'll talk about Canada U20, who look very, very close to qualifying for the U20 Women's World Cup. They've started the tournament with three straight wins. Against Trinidad and Tobago and Honduras, both by a score of 2-1, and then a destruction of Jamaica, 7-0. Three straight clean sheets and good performances from Taylor Price, who has three goals, and the Sarahs, Stratagakis, rather, and Kinzer, who have two goals each. It's, you know, it's exciting to finally see a Canadian team score a little bit here.
Yeah, this is one, again, it's a lot of goals, and Canada does not have that, especially on the men's side. And the women's side, you wonder how much longer Christine Sinclair can keep going for, really. So it's promising, and I think that, again, I'm not, you're the expert on every single Canadian team from the under six level and up.
Yeah.
Again, I'm the type of guy whose attention isn't to this yet, but I think that if they keep this going, I will definitely be looking more into it.
Yeah, well, the thing is, like, obviously they've played very easy teams, or not very easy teams, but there is still that massive divide in women's soccer between the tier one teams and the tier two teams, and all of these teams they've played so far have been tier two. But looking back at Canada, and I look back at a couple tournaments back, they don't score like this, and they don't defend like this either. Having 11 goals scored and none against is just, you know, it's a very solid team.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, and as I mentioned before, this is a second choice Canadian team. They're missing Jesse Fleming. They're missing a bunch of like names that are very recognizable in the Canadian soccer.
Man, if Kadisha Buchanan, that was she 19?
Yeah, she's 20 now. Oh, okay. So yeah, she would not be eligible. That wouldn't be fair. That just wouldn't be fair.
Negative goals against.
Yeah. But yeah, this is a very promising run from the Canadian U20 team. Now, with that being said, the promise does come down to the next one or two games where they play either the United States, and U.S. is playing right now against Haiti in a big match, which will, I guess, determine whether they win that group. They need to win by, I think it's 3 goals to be able to win that group. So that depends whether Canada plays U.S. or Mexico in the next round. You fancy them against Mexico the way this tournament's went. You kind of fancy them against the United States with that asterisk. This is the United States.
This is the United States. And again, in terms of their player development and just their talent pool in general, they are head and shoulders above the rest. There's the world, and then a level up, you've got Canada, because they do, again, like I was saying before, there's a lot of people that play soccer in Canada at the youth level. Mm-hmm. There is that talent pool there, but the United States just takes that to a whole other level. And just in terms of their physical stamina and their fitness and everything, the United States can just turn it to another gear that nobody else in the women's game can touch.
Yeah, absolutely. But at the end of the day, looks good for Canada to qualify for the U20 Women's World Cup, not to jinx that. But they do, again, if they lose this next game, they do have that third place game against likely a Honduras, considering how things have gone. And they've already beaten Honduras and would likely do it again if they played again. So looking very good for the Canadian U20 team. Let's wrap up the discussion there. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at The Real Nort.
Don't follow the fake Nort.
And at Mitchell Tierney, where we will probably be complaining immensely about our exams that are coming up. You can also read our work at WakingTheRed.com and at LastWordOnSports.com. And as always, we are on iTunes, so you can subscribe to us there. Have a good week, everybody.